chair, she was appointed earlier in the year. She was appointed earlier in the year as the CEO, and I wish I could say that she's brand new, but be assured that over the short couple of months, the vast volume of work that we've had to do makes her now an old hand at the institution. Chair, I have been asked by the board to also extend our congratulations to the committee in its entirety, this being the first session we have, and to convey the wish that we place high currency in developing a positive working relationship with the committee and look forward to that. I also acknowledge members of the department to whom we are indebted for their support of the institution. I will ask Ms. Mutlala to deal with the introduction of the executive team when she takes over. But before that, I did want to say briefly that we have been in the position of the board for the past 3 years. To continue the analogy used by the CISO's chair of robots, we perhaps can describe our role as having hit a very, very sharp curve over the past 2 years. And indeed, we are at the tail end of the curve. We do believe that there is a couple of holes ahead of us, but I think we are swifter and more able to negotiate those. And I think that a presentation by the executive team will demonstrate at least the recovery in comparison to the past 2 years and certainly the balance of the challenges. Without wasting time, Chair, I will now hand over to the CEO to help us along.
Thank you very much, Chair. Honourable members, honourable chairperson, colleagues, thank you very much, chairperson of the board, for that introduction. We are here to deal with the financial year of the Estate Agency Affairs Board for 2018-2019. Before I go into the introductions and the specifics in relation to the presentation that we're going to be making to this portfolio committee, I think it's important that we state upfront that the work in terms of this financial year is attributable not only to myself but to my predecessor, who is Nikita Sigaba. So we are jointly liable for the report that is being presented here today. But I think it's also important to also indicate that subsequent, obviously, to the submission of this presentation, there's been a very momentous and very important occurrence that has occurred. There has been the promulgation of the Property Practitioners Act number 22 of 2019. And I think this act is quite critical because it ushers in a very new era in relation to the property practitioner sector, and it also ushers in a very important era in the life of the Estate Agency Affairs Board. Now I will go into the specifics of the presentation. Before I go into the specifics of the presentation, it's important that we introduce the team that is sitting in front of you. I have asked my executives to actually accompany me to this specific presentation. To my left, immediately where I'm up there, is Karen Son. She's the acting CFO. We have Dinawam Pashela, who is the executive for inspections, and we've also got Jimmy Baloyi, who is the executive for legal compliance. The nature of the presentation that we're going to be dealing with today is obviously going to deal with all the work that has been undertaken by the Estate Agency Affairs Board in the last financial year. We are going to deal with the issue of the audit outcomes. We're going to deal with the issue of registrations. We're going to deal with education and training, and we're also going to deal with the area of transformation. And it's also important to just state before we go into the detail of the presentation that the Estate Agency Affairs Board is tasked with the responsibility of regulating the estate agency sector by issuing of SSCs, by creating standards for training and development, and by also making sure that we investigate all complaints that emanate from the sector in relation to specific transgressions by estate agents. Without further ado, Chair, I will ask that we start with the first area, which deals with the audit outcome. But I think it is important to state that there has been a marked improvement in relation to the audit outcome of the institution. Even though, we are sitting with a qualified outcome, but you will see that compared to the previous financial year, where there were 6 items which resulted in a qualification, we've been able to push back to only 1 item in relation to a qualification for the board. And you will see that it only relates to a small amount in relation to the commitment section. With regard to the audit in relation to the Fidelity Fund, you will see we have an unqualified audit. But I'll proceed to deal with the slides specifically on that. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson, colleagues, members.
I'll then hand over to the Acting CFO to deal with the contents of the audit outcome. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson and members of the committee and fellow colleagues. As the CEO has already alluded to, we have had an improved audit outcome from 2017 to 2018. 2018-19. You will see in 2017-18 we had 6 audit findings. These have significantly improved, and currently we are only qualified on 1 item, which is the open purchase orders. As far as the estate agent, the Fidelity Fund is concerned, we were qualified last year, but this year we have received an unqualified opinion because the matter in dispute in the prior year has been resolved. Okay. The next slide here. Okay. Just in terms of the financial results, okay, for the group we have total assets of 817 million. This is made up of financial assets, which includes cash and cash equivalents of 632 million, property, plant and equipment of 113 million, and accounts receivable of 45 million. I think the full detail is in the annual report, the financial statement section to the annual report. Our total liabilities is 92 million, which is made up of trade payables, as well as net current assets for the defined benefit obligations that we have in terms of the pensioners. But as you can see, our total liabilities have decreased from last year. Last year they were 124 million, they are 92 million this year. Our revenue, the Estate Agency Affairs Board generates all its own revenue. Of the 221 million, we have income from estate agents amounting to 181 million. This is primarily from renewals of the FFC certificates, which is the Fidelity Fund certificates, examination fees, new registration, interest on the trust account, which in terms of legislation, estate agents need to lodge with the board. There's also claims recovery, claims recovered of about 4 million. As you know, we do part of what the EAAB does is to investigate claims by the public. We do then try and recover those claims from unscrupulous estate agents, and that amounts to 4 million. Our expenditures are 194 million. That is made up, 83 million of that is staff costs, and the balance is operational costs. They are the details of the figures are in the annual report.
Honourable members, let's compare with the annual report, because this is just a summary.
Yes.
I'll ask Mr. Valoy to then deal with the registration.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honourable members, the CEO, Chairperson of the Board, and EAB Board member, colleagues, good morning. We have an enforcement and compliance department which comprises of four sub-departments, and my presentations will concentrate on that. The first department is the registrations department. In terms of Section 26 of the Estate Agency Affairs Act, every single person that seeks to operate as an estate agent in this country must be registered and be issued with a fidelity fund certificate, which is basically a license to enable them to operate as such. Now, in the registrations department, we register, well, new estate agents. We do amendments where, for instance, one of the already registered a member of the industry would want to change their surname or some details, the addresses. That's the department where we deal with all of those things. Now, we have an online platform that enables estate agents to interact with us. There's a seven-digit reference number, which is unique to every estate agent or agency, which must be furnished to us each and every time they deal with us. Because failure to do that would lead to a backlog in the issuing of fidelity fund certificates, amongst other things. Now, if we could go to the next slide, CEO, I'm just going to talk to the number of fidelity fund certificates that we were able to issue in the two previous financial years. During the 2017-18 financial year, we issued 49,650 fidelity fund certificate, and in 2018-2019 we saw an increase whereby we were able to issue about 60,883 fidelity fund certificates. That was about an increment of about 22.64%. The following slide talks to the total number of fidelity fund certificates that we were issued to each and every real estate entity. The previous slide, the 60,000 that I spoke about in the previous slide relates to individual estate agents, rather FFCs that have been issued to individual estate agents. Now this slide talks to the total number of fidelity fund certificates that have been issued to firms. And the number that you see relates to various provinces that which add up to 8,139 fidelity fund certificates that were issued, which is an increase as compared to the 2017-18 financial year, where we had issued 7,634 fidelity fund certificates. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honourable members. My name is Dineo Mphahlele. I'll be taking you through to the Education and Training Department. As the CEO has alluded, one of the mandates of the Estate Agency Affairs Board is to prescribe the standard of training for estate agents and also for new interns. So prior to a registration certificate being issued, a person who wants to qualify as an estate agent, they must go through an internship. The internship is a period of 12 months whereby an intern gets the practical experience as well as the workplace experience as well as the educational or the theoretical part of it. In the last financial year, in terms of the internship, those who have qualified and completed the internship were about 1,063 interns that we confirmed that they have completed their internship. And also what the EAB does is to ensure that when a person has done an internship, they also have a qualification, meaning they have a tertiary qualification. Therefore, those qualifications have been certified by the EAB to confirm that those who have completed or successfully completed is about 1,109 estate agents who've completed the qualification. The EAB also offers what we call exemptions. Exemptions are in a number of areas. There is an age-based exemption whereby a person who is 60 years and older is afforded an exemption by way of an interview and also submitting a portfolio of evidence. There is also a section where equivalency exemption. Equivalency exemption relates to the relevant tertiary qualification that one possesses, and they are able to be exempted from that. So we also provide professional designation examination. We call it PDE. This is examination that is offered by the EAB. Once a person has obtained a qualification, they are able to enroll for an examination. Therefore, it qualifies them to be either a principal of the estate agency firm or a non-principal estate of the estate agency firm. Under the period, under review, go back to, to the previous slide. The PDE examination, persons that set for the PED examinations were 1,546, and those that were successful were 1,134. In terms of the age base that I've just mentioned, we were able to qualify about 48 estate agents based on the age and the submission of the portfolio of evidence, and those that were exempted were about 185. The next slide. We also, in terms of the education, the requirement, we offer continuous professional development. This is where an estate agent has already qualified in terms of having an FFC. They've gone through the educational requirements, obtaining the national certificate. They've also gone through a number of documentation that has been submitted to the EAB, and therefore they are qualifying persons or estate agents to attend continuing professional development. This we call a CPD. They run for a period of 3 years, rolling cycle, and estate agents are required to obtain at least 60 points in that 3 years. Therefore, in a year, they are able to obtain 20 points. 20 points, it will be 15 verifiable points, and the other 5 is about non-verifiable points. The non-verifiable points is not offered by the EAB. What happens is that an estate agent can go through a training in any external service provider, and they can provide information that they have gone through that process. The ones that the EAB provide, they are verifiable points. These are mainly on the modules or on the topics that the EAB presents. Therefore, when you attend one module, which carries about 5 points, therefore you're required to at least attend 3 modules or 3 topics. Therefore, then you can carry for that particular year. So in the next 3 years, an agent will be required to accumulate 20 points per year. What has happened now in the current, in the financial year under review is that the estate agents that has attended contact sessions, there are about 6,904, and those that went through the e-learning method, there are about 7,735. We also offer an e-learning method on the basis that some of the estate agents are unable to attend the contact sessions, and then they opt for e-learning, and it also proves to be something that is more popular because an estate agent can perform the e-learning programs at their leisure of their home or at their offices other than attending the contact lessons. So we actually see a change around the contact session. When the CPD program started in 2015, there used to be a number of people who were actually attending in terms of understanding the programs or the topics, but now we see a little bit of trend and change where now they're opting to use e-learning or to use the method of e-learning because it's more quick and speedy for them and is also reliable for them because they can always do it at home. In terms of the geographical spread, we see that the CPD that we have offered to estate agents in the last financial year, in terms of the geographical spread, we see that most of them are in Gauteng, and which is followed by the Western Cape and also followed by the KwaZulu-Natal. And also, this is also informed by the number of registrations that we have and also the number of attendance. So this will actually be linked to the registration geographical background. I think at this point I'll hand it over back to the CEO.
Thank you very much, Chair. We will deal with the section that deals with legal compliance. This deals obviously with investigations in relation to complaints that are received from consumers or from the public. It specifically deals with audit outcomes, inspections, registrations, and Section 27 inquiries. I'll just ask Jimmy to then go into the detail of the specific area.
Thank you very much, CEO. As the CEO has already alluded, this is the department that deals with complaints that we receive from members of the public, and in some instances we also receive complaints or other contraventions from other departments like your audit department, inspections, education, and so on and so forth. So the graph below will illustrate the complaints that were received by the department per quarter. You'll see that in the four quarters, Chair, in the interest of time, rather, maybe I'll just take the Chair to the last quarter. In the first column, where it says open balance, these are the matters that have been carried over from in respect of the first quarter from the previous financial year, and in respect of others from the previous quarter. Now you'll see that in the fourth quarter we received a total of 2,838 complaints, and we add that to the one that were carried over from the third quarter, and it equals 3,355. Of the 3,355, we were able to finalize 2,692. And as at the close of the fourth quarter, we had only 663 to carry over to the next financial year. And the reason, there's a variety of reasons that contribute to the carrying over of matters. For instance, you'll find that in some instances, the matter is still under investigation, and we haven't received enough information. And in other instances, it will be matters where over and above referring the matter to the EAB, one of the parties would prefer to take the matter up with courts of law. So in that instance, we will receive a request to say, for instance, that due to the sub judice nature of the matter, the EAB is requested to hold over the disciplinary processes until the court process has been finalized. And in the next slide, this talks to the performance of the department vis-a-vis the target that we were supposed to achieve. Once again, Chair, let me concentrate on the fourth quarter. The Honorable Committee will realize that it's only zeros on the fourth quarter. This came about as a result of the fact that the contracts in terms of which disciplinary committee members were appointed came to an end, and therefore we couldn't do any disciplinary hearings in this regard. But, Chair, let me hasten to say that the majority of the matters that we are able to resolve are through the alternative dispute resolution process. So the disciplinary matters contribute quite an insignificant number when we look at the total number of matters that we have received. So I think that's all for now in regard to the disciplinary processes that we undertake. But we have since embarked on a process to install a new panel of experts that will assist us with disciplinary hearings going forward, and as I speak now, we are in the process of setting up those disciplinary hearings. Thank you very much. I'll hand over back to the CEO. Thank you so much. Sorry. Chair, you will recall that I mentioned at the beginning that the Enforcement and Compliance Department is made up of four, or rather, Enforcement and Compliance Division is made up of four departments. So Audit Compliance is one of those departments, and before I come to this particular slide, can we go to the second one, which tells us about the total number of audit reports that we have received in the 2018-19 and 2017-18 financial years. So back to the previous slide, you'll see that the number that's reflected in the slide that I've just spoken to, the audit reports that were complied, that were compliant, were about 87%. And those that were not compliant are about 13% in the current, or rather in the 2018-19 financial year. And as compared to the 2017-18, you'll notice that, that there's a slight decrease in terms of those non-compliant and compliant reports that we have received. But I must say that in regard to those that were submitted on time, the contraventions were not that much, and one of the problems, excuse me, Chair, one of the problems that we experience is that upon late submission of an audit report, an estate agency firm will automatically become disqualified, and then for them to be for that position to be corrected, they would need to undergo a Section 27 application, which I will talk to in the following slides. Now, in the claims department, we also have what, for lack of a better word, I would like to call a sub department, which is a Section 27 department incorporated into the claims department. The Section 27 department is the department that deals with disqualifications, and I'll give more details on that a bit later on. The Fidelity Fund has been established in terms of the Act, and it's administered by the EAB to assist members of the public who suffer pecuniary loss as a result of, theft of trust funds by estate agents, or as a result of failure on the part of estate agents to comply with the provisions of Section 32, which, amongst other things, means that estate agents must open and keep a trust account. So if a member of the public suffers financial loss or as a result of failure on the part of an estate agent, for instance, to keep proper books of accounting as required by the law, the Fidelity Fund will then be liable to reimburse anyone who proves that loss. The claim volumes rose significantly in quarter four, as you'll see in the slides that follow. the problem that leads to the fund being vulnerable came about as a result of a declaration of unconstitutionality of Section 32 of the Estate Agency Affairs Act by the Constitutional Court, which took away our inspection's powers. And therefore, we are not able to go out there and inspect estate agencies to check compliance with the Act. Now, the graphs, in the above graphs, as you see, talk to the total number of claims that we have received from members of the public. The figure in quarter one, in the first column, these are the total amounts that get to be carried over from the previous financial years or from the previous quarters. You'll see, Chair, that at the beginning of the first quarter, we had about 36.3 million rent in claims, and we also received about 3.7 million in claims for that particular financial year. Out of those, only 1.2 million was approved, and interest was also paid, about 11,736 share. So the interest, the committee that sits down and you know, evaluate or rather look at the claims that have been submitted and that check the validity thereof, has discretion in terms of the Act to grant interest where, for instance, the committee is of the opinion that the delay in the finalization of the matter may have led or rather prejudiced the claimant. So there are various factors that the committee will take into consideration before they do that. And Chair, with your permission, can I jump to the last quarter and talk to, for instance, the closed other column. This talks to claims where, for instance, the claimant hasn't been able to finish sufficient proof to found a claim, and in those instances, we can't keep the file open forever, and we are then obliged to close the file until the claimant comes back. And in some instances, those claims would be rejected on the basis that they have prescribed, because there's a time period within which a claim must be lodged with the EAB. Now, as at the end of the fourth quarter, the claims that were carried forward were totaling about 37.9 million rand, Chair. Now, the slide below, the columns below, talk to the Section 27 applications that I've spoken to. Where, for instance, an audit report has been submitted late, as I said, the estate agent will be disqualified and will then be obliged to undergo this process. Where, for instance, there was a disciplinary hearing and an estate agent was found guilty and they haven't paid a fine, for as long as that fine is outstanding, they will become disqualified. And once they pay the fine, we will reinstate them through the process. So this talks to those figures. If you look at once again, Chair, I'll talk to the last quarter. The matters awaiting attention as at the close of the fourth quarter. These are matters, for instance, where we're still waiting for more information in regard to the Section 27 application. And the next slide, the Section 27, okay, the next slide talks to the previous graphs that I was talking to. But then I need to mention, Chair, that there has been an outcry from the industry to say that the regulatory processes that we embark on are an impediment to entry, especially in regard to the previously disadvantaged individuals. Now, the board has since come up with what we call a special dispensation for PDI agents. This talks to the CPD programs, where, for instance, as my colleague has already alluded to, where, for instance, a particular estate agent has failed to accumulate points over a three-year period, and as a result thereof, they become disqualified. So we have put in place measures in terms of which we will assist them to catch up on those points, and whilst at the same time they are able to earn a living and pay the fines that have been levied against them. So we have devised a payment plan to in order to assist them in that regard. And the last one talks to the board resolution, what we call the PDI board resolution, which allows certain estate agents who wouldn't ordinarily be able to operate due to non-compliance, where we would look at those matters on a case-by-case basis and try to assist them in that regard in order to remove those impediments of entry to the industry. Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, CEO.
Chairperson, I also deal with the consumer awareness. We have a department that deals with consumer awareness and communication. Within that department, there are sub-programs will include media relations, where we deal with broadcast and print media. You also have a KPI in terms of the billboards that we have to place so that we educate the consumer. We also have a stakeholder engagement in terms of roadshows. We also have a social media. We have we manage a Facebook page where we also communicate through that platform. The activities within the department in the consumer awareness mainly is because we want to comply with the requirement of the Act that we have to educate the consumers. Therefore, we ensure that they have access to information in relation to EAB functions, and also making sure that the estate agents are aware of the mandate of the Estate Agency Affairs Board. We also educate them in terms of consumer rights, and whereby we also emphasize that they should deal with registered estate agents. We're also trying to improve communications between the board as Estate Agency Affairs Board and our stakeholder. Currently, we have a forum that has been established as multi-stakeholder group where we engage the stakeholder in terms of the changes that are happening within the industry, and we also engage them in terms of what is their view. So we have a successful engagement with our stakeholders. We're also trying to increase our visibility in terms of townships. We have previously received complaints that EAB is not known, and we are even moving towards going to the rural areas as well as the townships. And other important thing that we also deal with in that department is the education of the consumers in terms of how to lodge a complaint. You may find that estate agents may have disappeared with their money, and then we go through the process of lodging complaints so that they can recover their monies. The next slide will deal with the media coverage that the EAB has been covered in terms of broadcast and also in terms of print media. This has assisted the EAB in terms of reaching a number of consumers. You can see from the slides, because of the 60 online media and the 75 print media publication, we are able to reach a number of consumers out there so that they become aware of the Estate Agency Affairs Board. And if you look at the number of billboards in the financial year, we are able to actually underperform on that. We're able to have about 3 billboards, whereas we have targeted 5, but we're actually working towards that. I think that will be the end for me, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. We also have a very strong mandate with regard to making sure that we transform the sector. And in relation to that, the approach that the EAB has taken is to have 3 principal programs with regard to ensuring that we have transformation in the sector. The first one is the One Learner, One Estate Agency program. This is a program in terms of which young unemployed graduates, matriculants, and diploma holders or holders of other tertiary qualifications are recruited into the sector, and they're given internships, learnerships, and they're given candidacies. And in the course of doing of undertaking this program, what is intended is that we'll be able to recruit a substantial number of young people into the sector. And if we're able to do that, and these are persons from historically disadvantaged backgrounds, and the intention is that when we recruit such young people in as interns, we'll then be able to retain them as full status agents, so as to increase the number of historically disadvantaged individuals in the sector. Because I'm sure, Chair, you have noticed when you read the annual report that the numbers of black estate agents is very low within the sector, and we need to put in place specific initiatives to address that. So the One Learner, One Estate Agency program is one of the programs that we're using, and we believe that it is one that will be quite beneficial. In the financial year under review, we're able to get 1,000 estate agents, learners, and candidates into the sector. You will see that in terms of the program within the 2018-2019 financial year, we were able to get funding from Services CETA, but we have highlighted in terms of the table that's before you that there are certain challenges with regard to the payments of the stipends. So the EAB has actually been proactive, and we've put in place measures whereby we actually pay out the interns and the learners up front, and then we claim from Services CETA so as not to delay them. You will see that in the financial year under review, we had 171 learnerships. That is your NQF4 learners that came in. They were in the Gauteng province, Free State, Western Cape, and in KwaZulu-Natal. With regard to the candidacy program, which is a discretionary program, we were able to get 37 learners into the program, and they're also in the provinces of Gauteng, Free State, and Western Cape. With regard to the internship program, we're able to recruit 182, and these are located in Gauteng, Free State, KwaZulu-Natal, and Eastern Cape. And then in the last quarter of the year, we're also able to bring in a large number of learners, totaling 668. And you will note that with regard to that intake, we made sure that the geographic spread is in relation to every single province in the country. And I'm sure you the breakdown is available in terms of the annual report. But we have made sure that the geographic spread is equitable, and we will obviously be putting in place further measures to make sure that the equitability is maintained. The other measure that has been put in place in order to address the transformation challenges within the sector is our rehabilitation program. I think you did see when we were presenting with regard to registrations, we did indicate that the procedures and processes that relate to the
registration. Can you increase the font? Yeah. Bad. The ink.
Well, it's the PC. Is that better? Some more? Yeah. Okay. Is that
okay.
Better?
Yes, yeah, it's better.
But it just flows over. Okay. Right. As I indicated, the second initiative, I will roll down so that you can see the rest of the slide as I speak to it. The second initiative is that, obviously, of rehabilitating estate agents that have been blocked for various reasons. And the reason we are doing that is that we noted that a large number of the estate agents that cannot meet the regulatory requirements of the Estate Agency Affairs Board are individuals from historically disadvantaged backgrounds. So in line with the PDI resolution, the board has also put in place other methods by which we obviously identify these illegal estate agents, rehabilitate them, and bring them back into the sector. And over and above that, we've also noted that the reasons that there's a failure to comply with some of the requirements by the Estate Agency Affairs Board is because of financial challenges that these entities are experiencing. So we've also then put them into our incubation program so that when we do rehabilitate them and bring them back into the sector, they don't fall back into the same problems that they historically had. So we put them in the incubation program so as to make sure that they not only come back into the sector, but they're financially sustainable, and they're also able to continue to meet the educational requirements of the sector. In line with this rehabilitation program, we've also conducted a lot of stakeholder engagements throughout the country, whereby we've been educating estate agents that it is not good to operate illegally in the shadows. It's important that you come up front, and you come, and if you come up front, there will be no consequences if you voluntarily come up front and allow us to assist you to be rehabilitated and brought back into the sector. And in line with these stakeholder engagements and roadshows, we've been to the Gauteng province, we've been to the Free State, the Western Cape, and we are going to continue to roll out the program in other provinces in our second phase. We've also given them a training support program, and we've also provided a mentorship program that will assist these agents to come in. The other initiative that is being utilized with regard to transformation is the principalization program. In terms of this principalization program, we are aggressively approaching full status agents who are from historical disadvantaged backgrounds, and we're encouraging them to become principals with the hope that if they become principals and they start their own businesses, then that will help with regard to the retention figures. We've also seen that a lot of them have set up their own agencies, and we're continuing to encourage them to make sure that they set up more agencies, because that improves the level of people that they then employ, and it increases the numbers. We've got an entrepreneurship program whereby we actually skill these entities to make sure that they're not only just principals, but they're able to deliver in demands of the regulatory requirements, but also in relation to the business requirements of the sector. Because I'm sure you are aware that this is a very difficult sector to be in, because the financial rewards take very long to come through. So we obviously provide that support from an entrepreneurship program point of view. We have help desks within Gauteng, the Free State, and the Western Cape to make sure that we continuously interact with these entities. The incubation program, I think I've already spoken to Chair, that speaks to it, to how we have assisted them with regard to getting into the sector. I think, Chair, it's then important for us to then just move to the slides that deal with the supply chain program, with the supply chain management processes, and with regard to our human resource programs, so that we can then, so that the committee can have a full picture with regard to what the EAP is doing. And I just reduce it a bit so that,
Thank you, CEO. Okay, with regards to the supply chain management department, you can go to the next slide, CEO. Okay. Thank you. The EAAB does ensure that we comply with legislation. We do have a fully functioning supply chain unit. We make sure that we have bid committees that we set up just in terms of tenders, bid specification committee, bid evaluation committee, etc. We also make sure that we provide training to our staff to ensure that they are up to date with the relevant legislation. We update our policy on a regular basis, just making sure that we do comply. We also ensure that all the suppliers are on the CSD database. Members will, however, see that if you look on page 163 of our annual report, we do have 3.7 million worth of irregular expenditure. And if you look at that, you'll see majority of it is supply chain related. But I think that the details of that is in the annual report. There are investigations underway. One of the big things around the irregular expenditure was about $1 million that you'll see that's IT related. Unfortunately, when we procured the current IT system, the license is owned by one individual. So every year we unfortunately have to pay that one individual, and each time we need a change to be made, we need to pay that one individual, which unfortunately is irregular, which is why we have actually embarked on a tender process to develop a new ERP system, and this time we will definitely ensure that we own the license so that we're not continuously incurring irregular expenditure. Thank you. Then just in terms of human capital, for the financial year under review, the EAAB spent $324,000 on training. formal training, which is bursaries or a degree qualification, and then 175,000 on informal training interventions, and these would include workshops and conferences, etc., just to upskill our staff members. We also provided experiential training to unemployed graduates as part of the internship program, and we registered 10 of our permanent employees for the year under review on the NQFS Business Administration Program. Sorry, CEO, just can you go back one slide? Thank you. What we also did, we initiated a succession planning program by identifying key positions within the organization and just looking at potential within staff and placing those candidates on the program. During the year under review, we have also reviewed our organizational structure with a view to migrating to a new structure which will provide greater support to our overall strategy. And this is also especially important now that the Property Practitioners Bill has been promulgated, because there's a lot of things that are in the Act that we will need to do going forward. Okay, next slide. So I think going forward, our plans for 2019 and 2020 is just to migrate to the new structure. We need to also just ensure that we have enough employee wellness programs to ensure that labor relations within the organization continue to be stable. In other words, just ensuring the well-being of our employees, enhancing employment equity just to promote social justice and fairness within the EAAB, and just reviving the organizational culture through various initiatives and by implementing a performance management system. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. That brings us to the end of our presentation.
Thank you, Honourable Members. That was the end of the presentation that we were going to engage for today. I'm going to allow Honourable Members to ask questions for those three entities.
Before we ask the members, I wanted to clarify something on the liabilities that the CFO alluded to, and we didn't have details. Once the liabilities have reduced, it's not because of either maybe efficiencies, we changed the pension benefit. I'm sure it's been related in the past. So it was a change of benefit, so that liability, so that the entity is not indebted in the future for the pension of employees. So the greater part of that was because of that. So the other thing then is alluded by the AG, and from the audit committee point of view, we are improving, as the CEO has said, internal control systems. Thank you, Chair. And well done to the CEO and the team for improved, though not unqualified, audit opinions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Members, you are now welcome to ask questions, engage the reports. Because there are three presentations, each member can raise 9 questions for all three entities. The rule of 3-3 question pay is maximum 3. So you may not have a question. I'm trying to be democratic and say 9. But you can decide not to ask if you are clear. Honorable members, can I have your show of hands? Honorable Powell, number 1. Honorable Mohotu, number 2. Let's start like that. It will jump you if you are not speaking. Let's start with Honourable Powell.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of CSOS, my only question is, would it be possible to be provided with a list of all investment accounts into which monies have been invested following the loss of the 80 million rand invested with VBS. Actually, I have a second question. When will the outcomes of the S&G Grant Thornton probe be released to the public? The outcomes of that investigation have not yet been made public, so I'd like to know by when we can expect that report. And then in terms of the EAAB, I have a number of questions. So please bear with me. I've written them out because they're quite intricate. And if you'd like me to clarify anything, then I would be happy to do so. So Section 50 of the new Property Practitioners Act prohibits the authority from issuing a Fidelity Fund certificate to any person who is not in possession of a valid BEE certificate, and this extends to both natural and juristic persons. The implication of this is more than 40,000 estate agents will need to obtain BEE certificates as natural persons. And according to the new act, the minister does not, from what we can read, have the authority to issue a blanket exemption on this matter. So I'd like to find out how the board intends to assist with the issuing of more than 40,000 BEE certificates to natural persons. My understanding is this, that this cannot be remedied through regulations. Please can you clarify? I understand that the current board is actually a transitional board that was appointed by the minister on the 5th of July 2019. Can I please obtain clarity in terms of what section of the Act allows for the minister to appoint a transitional board, and if the board is therefore valid, and how long the intended length of service of the transitional board will be? And then there's just a bit of concern I have around the raising of funds in the trust accounts, because in previous legislation, estate agents were required to deposit interest raised by agents' trust accounts into the fund. I understand that the current legislation no longer requires agents to deposit interest earned into the fund. The board currently draws a management admin fee of 50 million rand, and the loss of that interest that was previously paid was in the last financial year about 44 million rand. So there'll be a loss of funds being deposited into the Fidelity Fund of more than 44 million rand through interest. Can I just get a little bit of clarity in terms of how that's supposed to work and whether or not those losses have been taken into account? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Less than nine. Honorable Mokoto.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question is on this entity, NHBR. Can you give reasons why? NHBC. Thank you.
NHBRC.
Oh, RC. Okay. I thought maybe I made a mistake. I omitted R at the end. Thank you. Can you give reasons why you submitted financial statements that were not in accordance with the prescribed financial reporting framework as required by Section 55 1B of the PFMA? You didn't take effective steps to prevent fruitless and wasteful expenditure amounting to 1 million plus. Why? And then the third one, why did you fail to submit the strategic plan for 2018-2019 as required by Treasury Regulation 30.1.1. Then the second one, the second bunch of questions is on this company, CSOS. Yes, CSOS, whatever. What are you going to do to cap fruitless and wasteful expenditure cost? What are you going to do in order to cap fruitless and wasteful expenditure cost due to the cancellation of tenders? And then the next question is, the decline in the number of registration documentation of community schemes submitted has a negative impact on your entity. What are you going to do to improve this situation? And then have you done research to find out what is the cause of that decline? And then the next question is on the next entity, which is EAB. What measures have you put in place to cap on non-compliance with procurement legislation, which led to fruitless expenditure of 2 million plus? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think my first question to NHBRC. NHBRC.
Hello?
Yes.
Honorable Mokoto, switch off your microphone.
NHBRC found many of our people because many of the quality of the houses that is really in poor conditions. People cannot enjoy the full benefit of the houses that they've been waiting for years. And my question to NHBRC is, how will you ensure that quality houses and quality houses or this inspections that you are doing ensure that the houses are in good quality? And then in terms of your social transform training, we want to see more females in the emerging housing and military veterans to be trained. And then in terms of the equity targets not met, in terms of your senior management, I see the targets in terms of males and females, there's little females there. And then in terms of your board members, we would like to see more females. And then in terms of your disciplinary cases, of 606 disciplinary cases, I see only 134 of the home builders has been suspended. What happened to the other? How many are there left? 300 or 400 and something home builders, what happened to them? Were they also suspended, or what was the outcome of their cases? Then in terms of CSOS, and there was an investment made. How far is this forensic investigation? And then in terms of your irregular expenditure of 26 million, what are you going to do to ensure that you turn around this adverse findings? And then in terms of, I also want to find out, there was a high court case in Johannesburg for stopping the vacancy, the filling of the chief ombuds. How far are that, and what was the outcome of that high court decision? Thank you.
Honorable Mosala.
Thanks so much, Chairperson. Mine is on slide 4. What slide is that one? Slide 17 of the NHBRC. When you page over to slide 18, there is social transformation of people living with disabilities. But when you go back to slide 17, it doesn't state anything about the work profile in regards to the people living with disabilities in this department. Can we get the stats of those people? Number two, my question would be directed to the CISOs. We go into slide 18 of CISOs. My question is, after the audit report, the AGSA audit report, there was an irregular expenditure and a wasteful expenditure. And then when you look at the mitigation, they're saying they're going to start with the disciplinary processes and the hearing is going to take place on the 27th till the 29th of November. But this irregular expenditure is for the year, financial year 2015 and 16. Why it took so long to discipline the employee? In terms of wasteful expenditure for CISOs, they don't talk anything about whether the disciplinary process was taken in terms of those workers that did that wasteful expenditure. And then number three, I just need a quick overview of the performance bonus for the year on review in all these three entities. Can they share a light with us of what is happening there? And number four, Chairperson, is with regards to, let me get it over. Number four is on slide 14 of CISOs. They say that there is a need to be an improvement in collection of revenue once CISOs has registered all the schemes in South Africa. How far is the database to capture community schemes? And the last one is also directed to CISOs. Why is there a failure and non-compliance in terms of payment of levies, which could lead to a continuation of a shortage in the projected collection? Thank you.
Honorable August. Thank you. Honorable Mvana.
My question is, I think, from the NHPRC. Slide, I think it's 12, it's 10, slide 10, and slide 11. They are talking about the registration and the renewal. But when you look at the registration, you will see that the renewals are lesser. And I would like to know, where are others or what has happened in terms of not to register or renew on time Oganye during that particular financial year. A reason for asking these questions, I used to hear that it is not easy to register with NHPRC. And the criteria that they are using, it's like climbing up the mountain. I used to get those comments, and it was not easy for especially those emerging contractors to register with them. So now I've got a proof from their presentation. CISOs, my assumption before I got the presentation, used to think that it's the worst entity I've ever had. But after the presentation, my mind has changed. And I think I'm a little bit understanding what is it that is taking place. And we wish you all the best and keep up the good work that you are doing. That's all the comments that I can do with CISOs. I was looking forward for this. I couldn't sleep practicing and planning on how am I going to get into this. Because previously, we had very, very bad report about you, especially in terms of the audit. Thank you, Chair. Oh, the last one, with this one of, what's the name of it? Hey, I was grappling to understand what is it exactly that they are doing. Now, I've got a little bit of an idea. So far, so good. I can just say the chairperson is look like his mother, Fana Krishna Mamake. Usobolisile here. We were trying to figure around. Thank you very much, chairperson. That's all what I can comment on the last one.
Thank you.
Order, Member Mvana, order. Dumelang baetapele. Chair, NHPRC has presented their objectives. EAAB and CISOS, you presented them through your verbal presentations. You have not just share one paragraph. But in the bigger documents, they are there. I'm just saying, Chair, sometimes you don't carry the whole financial statement. So that one paragraph of CISOS and EAAB, they could have set the start. On the NHRBC, your audit findings, can you cite just this one? You are unqualified and improvement, as you said, from last year. You have been unqualified for many years, which is good. But can you say this 2019, is it
2018-19? Somebody's phone on the, it's making noise in the mic.
It's on the table somewhere. Okay, it has been found, Chair. Cite one or two examples of his audit findings and what are you doing of them. Chair, the performance of CISOS, of NHRBC for 2018-19, they are saying they have performed Mbali 21% and 79% good. Also, can they just cite what were the problems there? Why couldn't they reach 100%? The subsidy enrollment, I had the reason, but I couldn't understand. In 2014-15, you were running close to 116,000, if I've seen well, or 36,000. The next year, those enrollment were less than half. And then they gradually get in decrease. You said the reasons. I think one of the reasons was that because of subsidy that you are receiving. I couldn't understand that drop. Just this 15-16, it's a big drop. Can you further explain? CISOS, you are acting, man. This was your acting, and let's not act. Let's be permanent or contract. Let's know, because acting position sometimes people is difficult to take decisions. So just work on that, and you can tell to the chair or to us through the chair of how are you, when are you going to deal with those things. Yes, please, my leader. And definition of a scheme is very clear in the document. Do you have these schemes in the townships, in the rural areas? Because what I see in the book seems to be very at tertiary level. Do you have it at that primary level? EAAB, Member Mvana wanted to say Viva, as she was excited about that. But the license issue, ma'am, that you explained the last input, I think I was going to, even if I'm not an auditor general, I was going to find wrong on that. Who owns this license and why are you paying it? The asset chairperson looks very good. They are green. Green and they are growing. As they grow, what are you intending to do? What are the plans? Could you also assist the department? I heard there was an application by the minister, I think it was for NHRBC. This money that is accumulating as profit, as assets, what is it doing, Che? Yes, in terms of transformation, training young people and all that, that's very important, Chairperson. But can we see this 10-year picture? What are you intending to do? And, Chair, these institutions, CISOS deals with these schemes that includes Section 21, that includes all those owners of properties and the like. EAB deals with estate agents, sometimes selling wrongly. Sometimes in close of a tin, usela igusha esemsageni, something like that. Do you know that? Yeah? No, it relates very well when you say it in that way. Chem protect, usually. Thank you. So what I'm saying is that, is there where you relate, where you could say, NHBRC, I've got a problem with this estate agent, and vice versa. CISOs could say the same, and vice versa. Is there a linkage of trying to lead this transformation? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think it's important to appreciate the role of CISOs when it deals with the issues of an immediate dispute resolution when our people are affected. But I'm worried about how do they get their data? How do they get their survey and have a data where they will be able then to have a target of certain schemes? Why I'm raising this is because they do raise that they are able to reach others, and it's been a long time where they are unable to do it. And at the same time, it is also mentioned in the audit findings, and they are unable to get to that. So the delays of addressing the audit findings also is going to incapacitate them, because when you immediately try to respond, get a better understanding of how you should do your work. So for how long are they going to delay these outcome findings, which needs to assist them? I do want to come to what my honorable member has just raised. There seems to be similarities of the work that they are doing with NHBRC. Do they have some networking process? Because seemingly they are concerned about the rights of the people in the industry in terms of their programs. Coming to the NHBRC, Chair, there's a lot of re-education program, which is a burden to the department. Amongst the areas of concern is the poor quality of houses. Very poor, and we see them visibly as we walk in our communities. I see that you do suspend builders when they have not performed according to standards. How do they enter the industry, those builders, firstly, in terms of recruitment and the standards? How do they enter? How do you... Bangena njani? Where is NHBRC when those people enter the industry to build? Now that you come to suspend them, because a lot of money has gone astray. Indlu, it's very expensive. And I shall leave the Indlu ngoku, builder. What is the plan? What is the program to capacitate these builders before they enter the industry? The poor people are bankable. I think this is what the program, the presentation is saying to us. But again, you have a process where those people just come because they want houses. Is there a program to capacitate them, to empower them? If you don't pay, you are out. If you don't pay, this is what is going to happen. You are taken to court. We've got many court cases, more especially in the Eastern Cape, more especially on the high density programs, the typology, the subsidies. Is that program strong enough? So that people should not get to a program where they will be unable to pay. Because the rights goes with the responsibilities. EAB chair, the presenter is saying our powers of inspecting have been taken away from us. When you look on the strategic role of EAB, they are to investigate complaints and they've got to verify those complaints, the correctness. Now, how do you do that when you cannot inspect? Perhaps say more clarity on the statement that have been raised. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Mashiko.
Thanks, Chair. Sure, on the NHBRC, I'm sure we must move on premise that yesterday the department did speak a bit on their behalf, though they were not there. So questions one might find himself repeating, but just comments. The first comment I would want to make is on the structure of the board. 14 board members, 10 males and 4 females. In 2019, it can't be acceptable. You are supposed to be a Section 21 company of a government that has declared a 50-50 approach on women and female and male on the structure. So you still can, at 10-4 on 14, it's very, very much lagging behind. And it, even when you go to senior managers, the structure still replicates the same. The worst part here, NHBRC, even in your training, because you have given us even your targeted training part, at senior management level, you only have got 3 women. But at the training level, you are not training any women to occupy senior manager's position. You are training them at the very lower ones. It might be creating a very wrong impression about yourself, on how you look at women, and I think we have, I did raise the point yesterday, but I was raising it to the DDG and the minister on your behalf. But I think let me just repeat it because it is really a problem. People might not take you serious in terms of your demographics approach. On the EABs. Look, I do think that Tom Lashas takes advantage of Ukulebake to just somersault bad into good. You we can't all of us come here with a bad intention. Well, just on the stick of weight, we are now convinced what has happened. But it being good as it might have been said, I think there is they must have a clear target of what is it they want to do and who must benefit from what they want to do. For now, we are too broad, and therefore you might fail to hit your target spot on. I'm talking about wrong people now. No, I'm talking about EAP. I'm talking about EAP. Oh, no, let me talk to Isos because I'm talking about EAP. Yeah, but let me finish with the EAP, it's fine. I mean, on the EAP, in the 12 looking now, therefore the target is a little bit further. I'll come back to Isos. You are saying, EAP, Section 32 of your constitution has been declared unconstitutional. And that then it brings about you being unable to investigate because your investigating clause has been declared unconstitutional. But you are not telling us what is it you are going to do. Why? Firstly, if investigation is something you need to do, how does your clause become unconstitutional? And if it is, you are not telling us what is it you are doing to correct it, save to report that. And you are no longer going to investigate because you have been declared. Then it means your existence is gone. You might as well pack your things and close shop because the bigger issue you must do is for you to react on the wrongs being done after having investigated. Now, if your power has been taken away from you to investigate, it means your existence is really challenged. And I think we really need to look onto that a bit because it just can help you to work better. On the issues, I think having said what I said about the chair, there is good, though, as I'm saying, there is generally a bad thing that has been said, and the board is saying no, that bad is just said does not exist, but it does exist, even in your own chair, that there is a problem that you're working on. The clear, in the absence of a clear-cut view having on what you have been saying, it creates about a problem in your existence. But I think both EAB and ISOS, what I think you need to do is to talk more about yourself in public. I was an MMC of real estate in Ekurhuleni, and in the real estate we are members of you by design. But I have not heard of you in my term as an MMC of real estate. Save for the fact that I once had the HOD mentioning one word, which in a very shattered way when it was just breaking for me not to understand what he's talking about. one estate agency. When he was just breaking, he wanted to go with the hope that I will be confused. But I couldn't because I was not even understanding what he was talking about. So I'm just asking that the NHLBC, we have heard of it because it is there, it is doing work. We hear it, we can see it happening, we can see problems. But with you, you exist for your own. I'm coming from a party that does not exist for itself. Born some 108 years ago, it exists for society. Nani, I think it's very old, 108. It does not exist for its own, it exists for EFF, the DA, and the others. So I'm saying you don't exist for yourself, EAB, and CISOS. You exist for community of South Africa. Please talk to them. Make yourself known. because they will need help from you. They can need help from you if they don't understand who you are. Please stop to be introvert, be extrovert, be talk to us, talk to people, then you can be heard better. But I really do want to agree with CISOs in their disagreement, Chair, for the, I know you are, you don't like that, but let me say it, because I think the Auditor General is a little bit wrong in declaring the 669,000 rand of ISOS wasteful and fruitless expenditure in the manner they explain. But they say they have gone out to advertise a tender. In the process of advertising, a whistleblower blew that there is a problem. So proactively they cancelled the tender system. But remember, they have already advertised, they have already called for bidders and so forth. So they have spent in the process 669,000 rand by only doing that, which is now being stopped. Now, when you...
Chair, I believe this is a question session. I don't think this is a session where Masego must come and give his opinion on what he thinks. Please call him to order. This is a question session. We have agreed that we will all ask questions. Chair, not elaborate and come and do grandstanding for camera. Thank you.
The order cannot be sustained because I don't understand what you are arguing upon. Honourable Mashaw, continue.
Okay, I'm saying the view that the committee says that, and I think it is a correct one, that when there is a view about what you are doing that you are doing wrong and stop. You cannot be seen to have been done wrong when you act on it. So I think that there must be a way of what is that we will call that particular thing. That's my view. But I know that it is already written here, fruitless and wasteful expenditure. You see, if you want to politic with me, I can. I don't want to do that.
You are protected. Yeah. Look at me and respond and ask your questions and comments.
Okay, I just don't like people to want to act smart when they are not.
You are very out of order now. You can't say that to us.
Honorable Mashego.
Must withdraw what you said.
I don't, and I can repeat it again.
No, Honorable Mashego. Focus on the
what will you
no, do? No.
What
Honorable Mashego,
no, wait.
Continue with the meeting. Honorable Mshala, please. Let's proceed.
Sir, Mashego is just very out of order. There's no way where the Auditor General said it's wrong. But they are saying
it's not upon you to do that. It's asking a question and then we'll...
It's just out of order, man.
It's not.
Question.
Who are you to ask that? I must ask you a question. You can go and be asked in Western Cape. I won't ask you that question. I don't want. Yeah. Why must I ask you? Who are you to, for me to ask you a question?
Honorable members, you are disrupting your own meeting. Yes.
Who are you for me to ask you a question?
Honorable members, you are disrupting your own meeting.
Camera is on.
Yeah, no,
I know when you see cameras, you want to be something else.
No.
Honorable members, let's focus. I'm listening to your questions. An Auditor General is in this house to respond to certain... We don't speak about... And I've spoken yesterday about what should be our stand. And he's a member. It's not the entity which is actually raising these things. And the Auditor General is here. He's going to clarify the member. And you are not Auditor General too. So leave this issue to Auditor General is present in this meeting. It's not the officials who says Auditor General is a member. So allow Honorable Mashego to speak. Honorable Mashego.
And I was
finalizing. No, don't add.
Continue. As I was finalizing, there should be a something that we can mention unto that particular expenditure as compared to the declaration as it is declared. But to me, it was a good action to stop continuation of wrong things.
Thank you, honourable members. General views in terms of the outcome of Auditor General is that entities, their outcomes, that there are issues that Auditor Generals are raising, would expect all of you to develop an action plan to respond to those issues as Auditor General has raised. But I want to emphasize is on the issue of supply chain management. Entities, actually you've made the department be very bad, because almost all of you, there is issues on supply chain management. I know there's been excuse with some that were being audited by other firms and they were not auditing like Auditor General, but that still is not material. The issue of supply chain management, we have to perfect the system. It's your policies. In the next financial year, we don't want to see anything that has to deal with supply chain management, because in this country, we're dealing with corruption and mainly is on supply chain management. We'll never accept anything that is raised on supply chain management. And that's why I've listened to Honorable Mashego when he's raising. There was a whistleblower out of the one entity. Whistleblower saying this tender is wrong. Then they've stopped it. But Auditor General might have his own view that will clarify it as if in the event where the whistleblower, it says this tender that is going out is wrong. Because there are several times that we'll do ourselves to say to ministers, if somebody calls us and say this entity has advertised the tender and this is the wrong things that they've done, we'll then call the minister to say, can you cancel that tender and re-advertise it? And it will be very helpful for Auditor General to clarify it, because we will do it even ourselves as a portfolio committee if that is been raised. But I think the bottom line is that nothing should ever come to this committee on irregularities on supply chain, because it's what has put this country where we are today. I think it's very clear. You should get the message. The second issue is on the NHBRC. In your registration, you show the decline of the home builders. What does it reflect? Is it people, they are not, they are those that build houses, particularly those that are being contracted by government, they decide not to register with yourselves and it becomes a normal thing with the department? So I just want to check on that. Or does it reflect that provinces, because we're dealing with the department and there was an issue that there are a lot of money that is being rolled over. Does it reflect then the performance of the provinces in terms of moving with speed in awarding contractors on for subsidies? Because we'll not celebrate that decline if it's based on wrong things, but if it's a normal decline, it's fine. Maybe you can comment on that. The CISOs, and I'm like Honorable Mvana. You know, I've been given
Honorable Mashego the task that when you come here, the thought must be on you, on all those issues. But what I didn't get it clear is that on the allegation of, or on the investment of the money to VBS, in your action, I'm not clear what you are saying, because I heard you talking about Reserve Bank, and I was asking myself, ungenapi, because the person who must be punished is the one that has invested the money. Who Reserve Bank ungenapi? Because Reserve Bank has done his job. The person who has invested the money is the one that must account for the money and tell us whether it was legal for investing in that bank. As municipalities now, they are in trouble, they are accounting, and people have lost their job, their position because of investing in the VBS. But with yourself, I'm not sure whether it's illegal, because it's a, so you are a community, you are representing community, and that bank is for community. So if you can just clarify, because the reason that you have given of Auditor General, I'm looking, not Auditor General, Reserve Bank, you're looking at that money, how you're going to get the money at the Reserve Bank. Reserve Bank has done its job, but it's not going to give you that money. So the issue is, have you done, is it legal for you to invest that money? If it was not legal, those that have done that, there must be an action, consequence management on them, if it's not legal. And would want the progress as these issues are being handled. and the accruals, as indicated, I think the CFO probably, we have to handle that properly, because we don't want accruals, because accruals means that you don't have a budget as we speak, because already you must pay the I've used my mother tongue to say, you know, in the simple terms, and skoloto overdraft, how unal overdraft chelete zenaka banking bawa kolota mbachia ya bona. So when our shalakainyan, and therefore it affects the money that we appropriate. We will make you to account for the money that we appropriate in term in line with your APPs. But if we don't handle the issues of accruals properly, we are going to have a problem. And we don't encourage to have accruals that would make the system to not to perform.
Which one is that
comment? The CISOs, you talk about the accruals as raised by the Auditor General on your financial statement. The Estate Agency Affairs Board, I just want to add on the part, the transformation, because, but I want to agree that there is the need for transformation, but transformation, if we handle it such that we are not focusing on the needs, or your needs is not evidence-based, you might produce the outcome that is not right. if you look at the provinces that you have picked up, majority will be, when you say Cape Town, is the city of Cape Town, when you say Durban, is the town Durban, Free State, it might be Bloemfontein, you know, you are still there. In with those people who have been benefiting in the system before. So you might produce the outcome that is not addressing the transformation. That's why we still have a challenge even after 25 years of democracy, of failing to narrow the gap of inequalities, is because how we intervene, we are not responding to the issues as evident on the ground. And the issue of raised by Honorable Mashiro, I'll need more clarity on that. If the Constitutional Court has taken that view, it has declared the Act, is it the Act? It won't be the Constitution. It would be the Act. And your existence is based on investigating and correcting the system. And they've taken that power. And I'm not sure what is the department. Probably the minister must actually assist us in terms of getting legal advice. How you should then rework on the act, because if it's declared unconstitutional, therefore it cannot. It must be amended. So you can then respond. Let's start we'll start with the first presenters, respond on your question, followed by the second one and the third one.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. From the NHBRC, we will be responding to the questions that have been posed to us together with my team. I've got my CFO and the head of legal that will be assisting me with responding to some of the questions that have been posed by members of the committee. I think let's start with the first question that was raised by Member Mokhotu regarding submission of strategic plans. And I think that the rest, it was around financial statements, which the CFO will be dealing with.
We are looking for
him.
Yeah.
I'm here, ma'am. The strategic plan of 18-19 was submitted, and I think the department and the AG being in this house can actually confirm to that fact. However, in the audit process, there was a need of a letter from the department acknowledging receipt of such a submission, and that letter was not available. And what we have basically then agreed or basically have ensured to do is that going forward, starting obviously with the year that we are currently under or currently operating within now, all the submissions as and when they are done with the department, that acknowledgement in writing needs to be availed. So the submission of the strategic plan was done. It's just that when the AG was auditing, they wanted an actual letter of acknowledgement of receipt. There was a question that was raised by the member on how will we ensure inspections assure quality homes. Members would remember during my presentation I kept on referring to the intervention that we have unleashed as the NHBRC in the current financial year, and that is of reviewing our current inspection model. Our inspections are happening. They are intended to ensure that we assure quality homes, but we are the first ones to acknowledge that they are not perfect. A And that is the reason why we've initiated this exercise with the University of Johannesburg to review the current inspection model, just to ensure that we improve on its efficiency and we improve on its reach in our communities, so that then it basically discharges or basically delivers on what it's intended to do, and that is to ensure that it assures quality homes. There was a question around social transformation of training. Members, I will refer members to slide number 18, where there is a complete breakdown of the initiatives that we have unleashed as the NHBRC that shows the social transformation training of the targeted groups, the previously the marginalized targeted groups. And I'm sure the demographics there will clearly outline where the biasness has actually been focused to, because you'll see that mostly it's women that have been trained across all those sectors, whether it's artisans and so forth and so forth. There was also another question around the transformation in management. Members of the committee, the numbers that you have in front of you is of the year that was under review, which was 18-19. I'm happy to report to this committee that currently the numbers show differently in senior management. The recent appointments that we have made in the NHBRC have actually been targeted towards women. We've just recently appointed an executive manager for corporate affairs. We've appointed a head of strategy as well, and both of them are female black women. So they're both black and female, and that has basically changed our complexion in terms of transformation agenda in senior management. So I would want to take this committee into confidence that we have corrected our numbers in senior management drastically in terms of the recent appointments that we have just done. There was a question around registrations and renewals numbers, and I think it has to do with slide number 10 as to why the discrepancy. And I think it would just be important that I explain to members of the committee that yes, you will have that discrepancy because each one of the activities happen at a different stage altogether. Registrations, they basically represent the number of new companies that registered with us in that particular financial year. Now, the renewals would have been those that who their registration would have lapsed in that financial year, and they then came through to renew. And I thought I should just explain that discrepancy, so that then there is a clear understanding as to why the two bars do not and will not be talking to one another. A member of the committee also raised the issue around the 18-19 performance breakdowns. And I'm sure slides number 19 to 23, because the issue was, what does this 79% represent, and why did we, what are the 21% all about? If you look at those slides between 19 and 23, they actually basically show our 18-19 performance breakdowns, and it will basically show that the 21% is represented by those that are reflected as pink, and those were seven areas that we could not achieve, but overall we had achieved the difference, which was the entire deliverables were 33 performance areas, which we then obviously underachieved 7, and then achieved the rest of the remainder. So it's that's what the 21% and the 79% actually represent. There was another question that spoke to the decline from 15-16 around the subsidy, because there was a show that there was a sharp decline in terms of enrollments from 15-16 to now, to the current. And members would remember that in my presentation I had indicated that enrollments in the subsidy sector, NHBRC is heavily dependent on provincial governments, obviously the development that is happening in provincial governments to submit those developments through to us. But as and when the plans or the developments decline within the provincial departments, the numbers will also decline. And you'll remember at some point I spoke about the recent policy shift within government in terms of housing development. So in 1415, Chairperson and member of the committee, there was, 1516, there was a huge number of developments because there was huge developments that were being rolled out at that particular point in time. But obviously currently the numbers have declined. The issue of the structural composition of the board, I think, is for the department, obviously, to consider, and then obviously revert back to the committee. I've dealt with the composition of our management team. I've indicated that we have drastically changed that particular picture. There was a concern that was raised around the difficulty in registering with the NHBRC. Members, we have, as the NHBRC, made it a point that we avail our services throughout the country and improve our geographical representation in terms of footprint, in terms of offices. As it is currently, we are finalizing arrangements with the South African Local Governments Association, where we will be obviously signing up a memorandum of understanding, so that then we are able to even access municipal infrastructure in terms of ensuring that it's easy to access our services. Builders have, you know, find it easy to come and register with us or to reach out to the NHBRC. But in terms of you being able to access our database as a builder, you write a competency test. Remember, members, we are charged with assuring quality. And for us to be able to assure quality, we require that builders go through a test. And unfortunately, a test is exactly what it is. It is a test. You're either going to make it or you are not going to make it. But we have made it a point that we are not as unreasonably, you know, difficult as possible. And we are going to ensuring that we train our builders, potential builders, to a level that they are able to meet our competency requirements. But as and when you are supposed to come on board onto our database as a builder, you must pass that competency test, which tries by all means to mitigate the risk that builders can go out and occasion to the general public if they are not properly, you know, tested and competent enough. I think, members, I've dealt with a number of the queries or concerns that were raised. I will ask the CFO just to deal with the financial questions that were raised so that then we conclude our responses. Thanks.
Thank you. Chairperson, your concerns and comments around the issue of irregular expenditure are noted. Actually, our council as well shares the same sentiment around this issue. However, Chair, just to bring some context to this, these were cases that were procured in the previous financial years without following the correct supply chain process. So now we had to finalize contracts in the past. Now we had to honor those contracts up until the expiry or the conclusion of those agreements. So in the last year, it was the last of the last payments of those contracts. So we are in the process, Chair, of cleaning up on our supply chain area by beefing up our processes, process maps, procedures to make sure that they are aligned to all the applicable legislations. There was another question, Chair, that was raised around the submission of the financial statements that did not comply with the applicable legislations. Members, in terms of our submissions, we had submitted the AFS to the Auditor General on the 31st of May for audit purposes, as well as at the end of July after they were audited. However, Chair, there were issues because in terms of the legislation, we need to submit financial statements that are free of material misstatements. During the audit process, the AG then identified some audit differences in as far as the numbers that we had reported. So there were engagements between us at the NHPRC and the AG, and then we agreed on those audit differences, and then we adjusted the numbers. Now, because of those differences, then they had to raise a paragraph in the audit report that then speaks to that area. So it is an area, members, that we are looking, that we are addressing currently in the current financial year, because the expectation from the members of this committee as well as from our council is that in this financial year we should deliver an unqualified audit outcome without findings. There was another question, Chair, around the examples of the audit findings that were raised by the AG. The one was around the definition of the definitions of our key performance indicators in terms of the smartness principle. The other one was around the, I think I've touched on the issue of the misstatement in the financial statements, as well as the issue of the supply chain management issues that were raised, which therefore affected the compliance issue. And then there was an issue that was raised around the bonuses. There was an issue on bonuses. As the NHPRC Chair at this stage, for that financial year, no bonuses have been approved by Council as yet. But I think, Chair, I've dealt with the issues.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson, on NHPRC.
Okay.
Chair, on the issue of gender balance of the council or the board, I think the representative from the ministers, the department is here. The board is appointed by the minister. And I think, I'm sure they have taken note of the gender balance. And in as far as management, we have taken note of that, as also the acting CEO was mentioning. I would like to come a bit on the issue of lesser registrations as well. On non-subsidy ones, when the economy is down, then there's less houses being built. Therefore, you register less because of what is happening. I mean, we should understand as well how the economy. So lesser houses are being built, so there will be lesser registration. Also, on the subsidy ones, we as NHPRC depend largely on provinces giving us their plans on how many houses they're going to build. So for instance, if they say we're going to build 20 and we have 20 on our, and when they build 5, then it hits on us because
we actually get affected. So we inspect or we register less, even though they actually gave us in terms of their books that they're going to be building so many houses. So we depend on provinces, as the CEO was mentioning. On the issue of of rectification, that issue of rectification was never a full program of NHBRC. It came from the Department of Human Assembly at the time when there were so many houses that perhaps were falling apart and needed. And at that time, most of these houses were houses that were built even before the existence of NHBRC. Therefore, our main issue now is to make sure that each and every house that is built, it gets inspected, and there is a warranty fund. If there is a warranty, anything that happens now, that house has got to be rectified. But it is permanently, it should not be a responsibility of NHBRC to rectify houses that were built before the existence of NHBRC. I thought perhaps I should run on those.
No, it should be your responsibility. You are the department. You are not outside the department. You are an entity of the department. So you must talk with the minister there is an issue of budget. You are a department. You cannot say you are not coming here. It should not be you. You, department, and yourself. So, thank you. You want to... on the issue. Okay.
No, we did not get a response in terms of work profile related to... people living with disabilities, that one. Yeah, thank you.
We're finishing NHBRC.
Yes.
That's why I've allowed her to... You want to follow up on NHBRC?
I need an answer on the issue that NHBRC hours need to be taken away. Did you get that? I'm trying to get that. And the other issue, I was leaving house in 1996, deputy board member of the CCMJ. In 1997, 1998, NHBRC was in operation, unless she's speaking about a board of that time. And how was the base, and NHBRC was under pressure.
No, I've corrected that. I think he understands the message. I've corrected that. Whether they were there or not, is their responsibility. You inherit the good and the bad in the system.
Yeah. Well, Chairperson, I think there's just a bit of a confusion between ourselves here and EAAP. Our inspections mandate or powers have not been taken away. We as the NHBRC, yes, it's EAAP, yes. Our inspection mandate still remains, and that is the reason why I was saying that it basically forms part a core for our business. There was an issue around the people with disabilities. My apologies, ma'am, for having not reflected on that. We have six members throughout the organization that are people living with disabilities, but there is also a concerted effort on our side to ensure that as and when we recruit, we prioritize that targeted group of people with disabilities. Like I have indicated that we had a challenge previously with women representation at senior management. A concerted effort was made, driven by our council, and that picture has drastically changed, and that is what we are also doing with the people with disabilities. We've got a social transformation committee as part of our governance structure that prioritizes those targeted groups, and we will definitely ensure that we improve from that number of six employees going forward. Thanks.
NHBRC or department?
Department in relation to NHBRC.
Okay.
The question on the board appointment, Chairperson, we always strive to have at least a 50-50 balance.
though sometimes it's not practically possible. But also we don't only balance men and women, we also incorporate the youth. I'm sure that the current board of the NHBRC also, we incorporated the youth, but we could not find anyone with disability. What has led to the current situation that we have at NHBRC is that the legislation also allows us to get a person from the DTI department. So that person has since also pulled away because of some other responsibilities. So what we will do with the department is to make sure that we get a female representative. But it is our main objective to balance the gender, including the youth and people with disability, on all board appointments.
Okay. You know, the issue of gender representation, never confuse it with the youth, disability, what. 50-50. It's either the 50-50 means that women 50, men 50. And if you include youth, when you deal with the women, it's either you bring the young youth, young women, or a young disability woman. So you don't use a youth, a young man as a woman. It doesn't work like that. So I think it needs to be corrected as we move forward. When iphela nini contract yap?
It's fairly new.
New.
Yes, but I must indicate that balance does not work against the male and female gender. Oh. If it is youth also, we still look whether it is a woman youth or it is a male youth.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. No, thank you very much. Can we go to Sisos?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to assist, perhaps we have grouped the questions that have been asked of CISOS into 5. The first group are those things that are to do with the AEG findings. There I'm talking about fruitless expenditure, cancellation of tenders, consequence management, research, non-compliance, or things to do with stopping the bleeding. So that's the first group of questions, those that are to do with the AG findings. And that's the group that I would like to start with. The second group relates to issues of registration, collections, and revenue systems, anything to do with collecting funds. The third group to do with dispute handling. Issues of the data to develop targets have been asked. The fourth group are those things to do with financials. The paragraph on financials, the performance bonus, the accruals. That's the fourth group. The fifth group will be asked concluding what has not been addressed yet. So I'll ask my chief ombud to help us with those to do with the audit findings.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the audit finding, there was a question relating to the fruitless and wasteful expenditure that resulted from the cancellation of the tenders. The fruitless relates to the amount that CISOS paid for the advertisement of those tenders. Those are then classified as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. There was another question relating to what then was done with regard to those who were involved in the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Were there any disciplinary hearings that were initiated? On the fruitless and wasteful expenditure relating, there were no disciplinary hearings that were initiated, taking into account the nature of the transaction because there was a whistleblowing. Then there was a question relating to the irregular expenditure in terms of it being or it happening during the 2015-16 financial year. The question why it took so long. The reason is that
the AGA to do an investigation into those tenders. The investigation started in 2018. And they issued a report towards the end of 2018, and it was tabled at our board during 2019 when the new board was just appointed. Then we had to initiate the whole issue of getting all those charges developed. Then we had to go and approach the AED for permission, because when we went to them to say we need to prosecute, we need witnesses, they said the AG must first approve before they can allow any of their investigators to come through to do the investigation. We approached them. They approved that the investigators might come through around August. That's when that, June, July, somewhere there. I think that is what caused the delays in terms of ensuring that the disciplinary hearing proceed. But we are on course in implementing consequence management on that. There was an issue relating to the payment of levies. Why is there a decline in the payment of levies? The payment of levies is linked to the registration of schemes. The more schemes we register, the more levies we get. We had a challenge in the previous financial year, more particularly in the first quarter of the financial year, where the payment was a little bit low. I think at that time it was when the whole VBS story broke. So there was some dissatisfaction within the industry which we had to address, and came up with mitigation factor where then the payment then picked up. In terms of the registration of the database, to say when, how far are we in terms of ensuring that all the schemes in South Africa are registered, and where do we find them? The database that we currently have, we found the information from the Deeds Office, which is the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. They managed to give us the database of all the sectional titles that we have in South Africa. That is the information that we are currently using to ensure that all the schemes are registered. In terms of the information relating to the Homeowners Association, we have approached the CIPC. They are going to be giving us the information on the Homeowners Association and the share block companies. That will also help us in augmenting the entire database of community schemes. And what we've identified is that if maybe we don't get all of them, then we can also approach SARS, who also have information on community schemes, retirement village, homeowners association. Further to that, we'll also approach the municipality, because they do register some of the homeowners association that are non-for-profit, that are common law type of homeowners association. So currently, in terms of the registration, we are tackling the registration as contained in the Deeds Office. We are going to start with the Homeowners Association and the Share Block Scheme soon, in terms of ensuring that we also get them on board in terms of them being registered, which will then have an impact in terms of the payment of levies, which will obviously increase.
Then we go to the financial one.
Sorry, Chair, I just want to come in around the issues of irregular expenditure and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. I think one of the questions was around how do we mitigate the trend in irregular expenditure. So one of the measures we've put in place is the procurement process would get to a point where the BAC has a report. And once that has happened, we then use the services of internal audit to check that process and give us assurance that that process is compliant before we get to award stage. So that process is in place to ensure that all of the procurement processes, steps that should be followed, are followed. And if they weren't, we need to understand why they were not. So this is before actually we award on procurement. Remember, the challenge is oftentimes you find you've awarded and then you realize, and then you start spending on that contract, and obviously that's how it becomes irregular. So that's our mitigation process going forward. Chair, and then I think on fruitless and wasteful expenditure, Chair, I think it was unfortunate that that you know, we incurred this advertising expenditure and then it was, I think we had some arguments with the AG, but ultimately we took it on the chin that it's fruitless and wasteful expenditure. If you take that out, I don't think we have any other fruitless and wasteful expenditure. So we are hoping in the new financial year, given that to date we've not received any whistleblowing information that would make us cancel a tender, that our fruitless and wasteful expenditure will be zero. But we continue to monitor that, and hopefully it gets to that point. I just wanted to make those two comments, Chair, before the AG comes in.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I was hoping to be an observer today after my presentation yesterday. However, I'd like to, ensure the Honourable Members that we are guided by prescripts when we conduct our audits. And on this particular matter, we looked at Section 13 of the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act, which is commonly known as the PPPFA. Now, that section lists the number of instances in which a tender can be cancelled. Now, when we audit, we then look at the reasons for the cancellation, and we test those reasons against that particular section of this act. And we couldn't then find that it met the requirements of a cancellation. And another thing that we considered was that this was a second cancellation. At least this is from the finding that we identified. It was a second cancellation, and that particular act also says you then need National Treasury's pre-approval before you can cancel a tender. And we looked at the correspondence with National Treasury, and National Treasury themselves also did not agree that the reasons were sufficient for the tender to be cancelled. So that was the basis of the finding. And also, funny enough, we also look at the policy of the entity. It also lists reasons and circumstances in which a tender can be cancelled. So it was not a subjective conclusion. We did test it against the requirements of one, the Act, as well as the CISOS's policy. Thanks, ma'am.
Can we go to the finance one? Performance bonus, paragraph, and the accrual.
Chair, sorry, man. Maybe just ask my sister there to respond. There was a question around these schemes. Do we have them at primary level, township, and like?
I'll start with the question relating to the bank accounts into which the investment were made. There was an investment that was made into the FNB account. The account holder was VBS, and there was an investment made into the APSA account. The APSA account money was retrieved, or CISOS managed to get that back, and then National Treasury managed to ratify the non-compliance in terms of the opening of that APSA investment account. The VBS account one is the one that is then the subject of the investigation that was done. There was a question in terms of when will the outcome of the report in terms of that investigation be made public. There was a report, the GT report was the investigation that was initiated by the Minister of Human Settlements. So the Minister of Human Settlements will be the one that will release that report. Then there was an issue in terms of the performance bonus. There was performance bonus that was paid to CISOS employees. What they did is those who were involved in irregular expenditure or who were found to have committed some transgression, they didn't get anything within the financial year. Then the issue in terms of the schemes, whether we have schemes in the township and rural areas, by definition, we will not have schemes in the rural areas. In the township, there might be some in the form of housing cooperatives. Those are some that we see them being established within the township. Thank you.
Chair, can I just come in terms of the question around accruals? I think, you know, accruals are both debtors and creditors accruals. In the CISO scenario, it is debtor accruals. So it's not us owing people, it's people owing us. So what happens is, post the 31st of March, people are still paying us on the 1st of April, 2nd of April, 3rd of April. Unfortunately, the challenge is that the end of the quarter from our perspective is also 31st of March, and you tend to have people paying after that period. So we've got all of these accruals that come post year end. So those are the accruals. So it is not payables related. Thanks.
Chair, what I would like to do is just to finish the balance of the questions, but I'm sure you need a little bit more on the VVS thing, because I had the questions that we assumed a lot that people already know what we are talking about. Just to clean up on the acting positions, that we take the point that we've got too many acting positions, but as indicated, and it will come even in the VVS report, the acting chief ombud and the acting chief financial officer are things emanating directly from that unauthorized investment into those banks. So we will get that. The issue of the definition of the scheme and the whole issue of townships, obviously I was envious of EAAB when they were talking about transformation. It's something that obviously we at CISOS are constrained in terms of doing that. But it did expose me having to address a township audience when I was asked to tell them about CISOS, and they were wondering, what are you talking about? So to me, I think I take that message that let's talk more about what we do, because people don't know. Even I didn't know about CISOS until I see it in my bill that the CISOS levy, but I never understood it. But the big thing is the NHBRC. They've got a big truck. You can't miss it. And it gets people to know about something called NHBRC and what does it do. People start. We need to start thinking about marketing and communicating in that level of scale as well, because we don't really do much in terms of popularizing what we do, and let alone talking about what entities in the townships can be established to participate also in this model. Then the link that's really what my experience was with talking about how does CISOS fit into the township communities. And the last thing is that I just wanted a little bit of assistance just to put context on what happened with the 80 million the 80 million rand investment, because just so that people know, this is what happened and these consequences that we are busy with now.
Are you able to help us, Tori?
Thanks, Chair. Chair, maybe let me start with the question you raised. Was it legal to invest? Yes or no? And so it was not. It did not follow Treasury regulations. So because, I mean, ultimately, Treasury regulations is what we need to comply with. And that came out through the two reports. There's the report initiated by the minister, which we call the GT report, and then there was the CISOS board report, which is the KHL report. So both of those reports came to the same outcomes or conclusions around the legality of the investments. Chair, so I think maybe that probably summarizes the issue.
Out of those reports was a disciplinary hearing on the people that were affected who authorized that payment. And there was the DC, the outcome of which was
CISOs has got no jurisdiction to discipline those people. And while that was happening, the second main contract of those people expired, both the chief ombud and the CFO. So we had to stay without the chief ombud and the CFO on a permanent basis until this matter was resolved. It's only a week ago where the court pronounced that because the previous acting ombud was preventing us from recruiting a chief ombud. So the court then says we have every right to appoint. So we've just been cleared about that. With regard to the CFO, the term of the previous one ended as well. So we have submitted to the minister our submission of who we think should be appointed, and that submission only came back to say the minister concurs with our definition of our submission. I don't want to add fuel because then the person had left. So he's no longer available, the person that we were recommending. But that's the context in which the investment, it was an investment that was not authorized, and that's why we are busy doing this. In terms of the chairperson's question on why we were talking about Reserve Bank and all the others, the starting point was we knew that the account was at FNB, and we applied to the court to freeze the amount at FNB. Obviously, FNB said the account is not in your name. We can't be told by you to freeze it. It's in VPS's name. So we were told that the application is not urgent. It will go in the roll when it's time to put it in the roll. Then, obviously, we want to trace where the amount is without, obviously, getting the information from FNB. So we went to lay a charge at the police station. That was late. Then we said, what other parties can assist us retrieve this money? That's why we talked to the Reserve Bank, because the Reserve Bank is the one who caused the investigation to happen. So we wanted them to know that there is amongst these monies money that was irregularly taken. That's how the Reserve Bank comes in. We did report because there's a person's name that features right through who kind of worked with us or also worked with the bank. So it's basically, so that person, we also reported him in the authority, the finance authority. So what we were doing is to close all the areas where we can actually get conclusion on this matter by reporting for people to be disciplined by their professional boards and others. We went to the SIU. There's literally nowhere where we have not reported this mishap. And the idea is, hopefully, throughout all these efforts, even though it might not get back to CISOs, at least it will go back to Fiscus if they can track it and check it out. That's in a nutshell, what the VBS is about. That's what the article in the last week newspapers was just talking and trying to create the story that was a year old.
But follow up on that, do you have the resolution of the board around investment, or is the officials only, or do you have the resolution of the board?
Thanks, Chair, I'll come in, but the company secretary maybe is even more appropriate. There is no resolution of the board, and that comes out clearly in the two reports I mentioned earlier. So there is no board resolution to invest. So I guess it's the two officials who were fingered or implicated in the report.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. That was our input.
Chair, there was a question on the release of the GT report.
by the Minister of Human Settlement.
The GT report was commissioned by the Minister.
I'm responding.
It's responding.
Oh, she's responding.
Chair, the report was indeed commissioned by the Minister of Human Settlements. It forms part of the handover report from the former minister. But in between, we had these court cases by the former Chief Ombud challenging his suspension, because hence also the decision of the High Court of the 25th of the 9th. So the minister was considering that report. And I'm sure now that the matter is closed out, then the report will be released. Also, that is in line with the stakeholder engagements that we had with the CISOs, where the stakeholders, they requested that we must come back with the outcome of the report and also what we have done and what is the status going forward. So now that the matter is closed, I'm sure the minister then will be finalizing the engagement of the report, and then there will be a release of the statement to the stakeholders. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. The last entity.
Thank you, Chair. Mindful of time, Chair, I've asked the CEO to lead us and to lead us as efficient as possible. There are just two comments I wish to make, Chair. There are a number of questions that were asked, including the issue of inspections and some questions related to transformation. Our approach, Chair, was that we had the opportunity, given the bill, to deal with the limitations through the new Act. And indeed, the new Act now allows the entity much better space around inspections, and I think we'll get a little more detail. It certainly offers us tremendous opportunities around the question of transformation. Not only now are we talking about it, we will be able to fund transformation within the entity rather than be reliant on outside parties. The headline question that really the board should respond to is the question that came through from Honorable Power. It's also a question that came through from one of the industry players that we must explain how the minister has appointed the board in an interim capacity. Unfortunately, we did with them advise them that the appointment and the appetite is the minister's process and appetite. So the competent authority to respond to that question is the minister, and we respectfully advise them, as we do this body, that perhaps that question could be placed before the minister. The assurance that I can provide to that question is that the board of the AEB is composed of professionals, and by that I mean lawyers, advocates, some of them have been called to act as judges, accountants, developers, town planners, and these are people who are fruitfully otherwise engaged, and so they see this as an act of service, particularly when you look at the sacrifice under the new Public Audit Act, the responsibilities that come with it.
So,
yeah. Okay, thank you.
Trying to motivate now with my motion.
Okay, no. So I will then leave it at that. Those were the two issues. If we had time, I would deal with the question of looks, but I will grab the compliment, Chair, and simply move on. Thank you.
Let's allow, they're still going to respond. They're not finished, Honorable Power. They're still responding on the AEB. They're still responding on all the questions. The follow-up will come after they finish. Honorable Mohlala. Hey, promotion. No. Because we have Mohlala here. Okay. CEO, sorry.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Chair, I think on the first issue around the inspections, I think the chairperson of the board has to some extent responded to it. But I think it must be understood that it is correct that for the past 4 years, our hands have been tied behind our backs based on a constitutional court decision. Because one of our licensees, Auction Alliance, took the EAB to the Constitutional Court, challenging our powers of search and seizure because we had done an inspection, seized certain documentation from them, and they felt that the powers that we had were excessive. And the Constitutional Court agreed with Auction Alliance and then indicated that the powers that we're using for search and seizure in terms of the Act were unconstitutional. But now with the promulgation of the Property Practitioners Act, as I stated at the beginning, that is now remedied because there's Chapter 5 and Sections 24 to 30 deal specifically with those powers. It now clarifies what are our powers of search and seizure and under what circumstances our inspectors can use those powers. So now we can continue to act in terms of those specific provisions. The other question was in relation to Section 50 of the Property Practitioners Act. It's correct, Section 58, subsection 10, does specifically speak to the fact that for an individual to have a valid FFC, they need to have a BEE certificate. That is now a requirement. But it must be understood that and then the question then obviously was in relation to will we be able to then issue over 40,000 new FFCs in response to that requirement. We believe that we will because the Act does cater for it. There is a transitionary provision under Section 75 that speaks to our powers on how we put systems in place in preparation for the Act to come into effect. And we believe that we'll have a period of about 6 months to put all systems in place. And then in terms of Section 77, the President then has the authority to promulgate an effective date. Then we'll all know that from that date, then the Act will be. We will then be now expected to act in terms of the provisions of the Act. So all systems, resources, plans now need to be put in place in preparation for that effective date. And I believe as part of our preparation, we'll make sure that we have resources in place to make sure that we have a proper licensing regime under the new dispensation. There was also a question about the interest that is to accumulate to the Fidelity Fund and the fact that estate agents no longer have to hold, no longer have an obligation to hold their funds in trust, which then obviously will affect the amount of interest that will accrue to the Fidelity Fund. Yes, we are very much aware of that. In fact, that is an issue we're already grappling with before the promulgation of the Property Practitioners Act. And we believe that there will be the regulation making process whereby the department and the EAB will engage. And we will look for a mechanism by which we would make it obligatory for estate agents to actually put their funds in their trust account so that the interest can accrue to the Fidelity Fund. Because if it's not kept there and it's not made obligatory that they keep the money there, then we will not get money into the Fidelity Fund. And I'm sure you know that one of the uses of the Fidelity Fund is to make sure we have transformation. So it's a very important funding mechanism for transformation. So we'll discuss that with the department with regard to when we do the regulations. I didn't quite get the question on the management fee. There was an indication that we do get a management fee, but just maybe to talk to the process, yes, we do have a management fee whereby the Fidelity Fund pays the board for the administration of the Fidelity Fund, and this is a fee that can be drawn on monthly basis or periodically as and when it's required. And there is a policy in place that determines. So it's not a situation of the board just sitting back and not doing any work and then we just draw money from the Fidelity Fund. There is a policy in place that has been approved by the board, and it also sets a maximum threshold of the amounts that we can draw from the Fidelity Fund. So there are rules under which we draw the money from the Fidelity Fund. It sets a threshold, and the AG also audits to check that there is no abuse of the Fidelity Fund monies through this management fee. There was also the question around the issue of the IT license. Yes, the issue of the IT license is problematic. It is a historical problem, and it is something that we are looking into. It's not just the one licenses. There are various. We found that there's a huge segmentation with regard to the IT licenses at the EAB, and we find that that ends up resulting in the fees being much higher than what they should be. So what we have done is we've looked at all the different licenses, and because government has a transversal contract with Vodacom, we are seeing how we can then, in line with that transversal contract, we were obliged to get services from Vodacom. We're looking to see how we can then fit in all the different configurations and review those contracts so that you don't have a private sector entity having complete monopoly over how our IT systems work. But over and above that, the board has also approved the appointment of a chief information officer who is a qualified IT specialist who will also then be helping with regard to not only the licensing concerns we have, but also with regard to the IT system to make sure it runs more efficiently. And I'm sure you would have seen that we've also in the media advertised for an ERP process, which will then be a comprehensive IT solution for all the challenges that we've had. With regard to investments, it is correct that the EAB is collecting a substantial amount of money, but currently the money is being invested in the open markets. But I think offshore, and we obviously have an investment portfolio. But the board has indicated that it is quite critical that we have a structured investment process so that the money then yields full value for the EAD, or the returns on that investment yield a full value for the EAD. We are in the process of procuring the services of an investment consultant who will then come up with a comprehensive investment plan as to how that money needs to be invested. On the issues of transformation, I believe there were two questions. The first one was, how do we work together with other entities? We believe that you will see when we come and speak to our performance in this financial year that we are in the process of putting agreements in place with different entities in the state to see how we can synchronize our transformation programs, and we will be talking to national departments, provincial departments with regard to how we synchronize it. There was also the issue raised around whether our transformation initiatives really go to the core of the problem, meaning ensure that there's rural development or benefit in rural areas in relation to that. We are in discussions with the Department of Rural Development because we do realize that you can't just you're transforming and only go to the metropoles and to some of the provinces. So we are discussing with the Department of Rural Development to see where we can have synergies with them. But over and above that, we've also had discussions with Contralesa to see how we can get to the most rural parts of this country. And in the recruitment processes that we're now undertaking for our internship, we do go to the most rural parts of our country, and you will see that it has a complete provincial spread to make sure that there is no province that is left out. And in provinces where we find that that black estate agencies are not as many as we would like, we're actually in discussions with the different provincial governments departments to see how we can team up and stimulate those and stimulate the development and growth of black-owned estate agencies, but also interest in the estate agency profession. On the issue of public awareness, we fully agree, and I think this has been raised by the board a number of times, that we need to increase awareness. People need to know about the existence of the Estate Agency Affairs Board and what we do. You will be seeing in the short term that there will be a definite improvement with regard to that. We have a program on billboards. We've got a program whereby we're going to go to use the electronic media, put out advertisements, and do more interviews with regard to what we're doing and the initiatives that we have in place. But over and above that, we will also be having workshops or roadshows so that we can speak to people in the different provinces with regard to what we do. And then, Chair, I think the last issue was about the objectives, and we do take that point, Member. We did make an attempt to speak to the Secretary of the Committee before we started to ask if we could put in one additional slide, and because we realized that we needed to obviously deal with the issue of objectives. But we're told that once the slide is in, the presentation is in, we cannot amend it. But the objectives of what the EAB does are on page 15 of the annual report. And just briefly, in response to your request, the objectives are to improve compliance with the Estate Agency Affairs Act and the fund. Are you fine? Okay. And then I think the others were just around the audit findings. I'll just ask Karen maybe to just speak to the issue around how we'll curb irregular and fruitless expenditure, and two audit findings and what can be done. But Chair, I just also wanted to indicate that yes, we are mindful of what you have said around development of an action plan. We are already working on that. In fact, as recent as yesterday, the management committee of the EAB was already dissecting the findings of the AG, and we are starting to put in place an action plan in order to make sure we don't have repeat findings. Even on supply chain management, we are very mindful and we are looking at it closely. But
thank you, CEO. Just on the area of supply chain, I think we are, as the CEO has said, we're really very aware that we need to curb our irregular expenditure and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. So one of the things we've done as part of the action plan is we have developed a standard operating procedure that we are going to be communicating to all staff. We've also decided that we really need to have a training initiative so that all our staff are aware of the prescripts in the Triple PFA Act. In addition to that, Chair, one of the other measures that we are looking at is to curb, especially fruitless and wasteful expenditure, is to recover funds, especially like interest on late payments. So staff are very aware that if they are the cause of penalties and fines, that those funds will be recovered from them. Then just the other question around the performance bonus. For the financial year under review, we have not paid out any performance bonuses to any staff, and that is, I think, you'll see on page 148 of the annual report.
Thank you, Chair. From the audit side, Chair, we're happy that the committee insists on nothing or no zero tolerance towards non-compliance and irregular expenditure. That assists us that we expect accountability at all levels. Then I'll refer you to page 72, members, and page 96. The audit committee raised issues on process that are underway to put systems. Because it doesn't just happen, we need to put systems, internal control systems, whether they are IT, whether it's human resource. So the audit committee has raised that. And so it's AG on page 96, because it even said significant internal control inefficiencies have led to that even one qualified item. So we are aware of that, and obviously I know the supply chain management position was advertised, so basing resources in place, and there's also systems, the CEO reported about it, the ICT system. And that's about it from the audit committee side. Thank you, Chair and members.
Department?
Thank you, Chair. Just on two issues. One is on the appointment of the interim board. The question is what section of the Act was used. I must indicate that the legislation that we're using, the EAAB Act, is 43 years old. It's dated 1976, so it's highly unlikely that we would have had a section that was referring to issues of good governance. So the appointment of the interim board was, we use the good governance. We piggyback on issues of good governance, and the minister can actually do that. And why the interim board and for how long? The interim board was appointed until the new board under the new act, which has just been ascended into law, is in operation. We are just now waiting for the date of effective by the president, but I must also indicate that we have already started the process of the appointment of the new board under the new legislation. The last one, Chairperson, there is a call from the members of the entities to work together, and this is also the guidance that we are giving to all our entities. There are a number of areas where the issues of collaboration can yield better results. We have given enough guidance to all our entities to say it's not only about them individually. It's about the country, it's about the sector, it's about all the key stakeholders and our beneficiaries. The issues, if I can just make an example, that we have elevated the issues of collaboration. As you are listening here, you had the issues of consumer education. It cuts across. The issues of training.
Already the NHBRC, they have been tasked to run the sector training academy. So we have also given the guidance to all the entities that all their issues of training, let them collaborate with the NHBRC so that we work together as a department and as a sector, and in that we will achieve more. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Power. You wanted to do a follow-up question.
Thank you. Thank you. The answers have been very enlightening and for the most part, adequate. I also just want to put on record that we welcome the attempts at the transformation of the industry. We are not in any way resistant to that. My questions are merely questions of clarity from operational and administrative perspective to ensure that this is this process can be streamlined and that there aren't any hiccups in terms of what the prescripts of the new Act require. I do, however, have one question of clarity to the interest accruals. My understanding from your response was that, I wrote it down, I just want to get it here, that the new Act will, through the promulgation and development of regulations, make the payment of interest on trust accounts by state agencies into the Fidelity Fund obligatory. I think that was the word that she used, obligatory. Now, my understanding as a legislator myself is that a basic principle of legality is that a regulation may not seek to extend the mandate of what has already been prescribed in law. So it may not extend the prescriptions of law. I also do understand that in the NCOP, when this Act was passed, this was raised as a question and the same response was given. I just would like to caution that there may be legal difficulties around now through regulations prescribing to state agents that they have to invest interest accruals into the Fidelity Fund when the legislation itself does not mandate that. My question, therefore, is does the board envisage a legal challenge around this, and could you elaborate on specifically what you intend to use the regulations to do with regards to the accrual of interest, because I think that there are many estate agents out there and agencies that are desperately seeking clarity, and it's a potential issue of major contention going forward.
Let's get the response, the last response, Honorable Members. When the response don't get agitated and wants to raise another one. CEO.
Okay, so thank you very much. I'm sure, Honorable Member, I think you have yourself have alluded to the fact that this is a contentious issue, and there have been many debates in the legislative making process. And the answer that it will be dealt with in the regulation making process has been the answer that we as the AAB have understood to be the solution to the matter. But obviously we still have to engage with the different stakeholders and obviously engage with the DHS. And I believe that even in a regulation making process, there is a public process part of it. And at that point, I think then there would be debates with different stakeholders and industry. And that, I think, would then obviate any need to litigate, because I believe those debates will then yield some kind of agreed way forward with regard to the matter. So I do not believe it will result in litigation, because even in a regulation-making process, there is a public process part of it, and the industry will be allowed to make inputs. And I believe that both the EAB and the department would then have an opportunity to justify whatever approach is being taken forward, and there will be legal advice that will then be provided on an ultimate solution. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, entities of the Department of Housing. I think it was a fruitful meeting for the fact that it's... human settlement and water and sanitation. Yes, and they're still using 1976 laws. They want to correct me. Housing is a 1994 thing. So, but it's fine.
it was a good meeting, and we'll continuously engage on yourselves. But what work we'll need as a committee, as the department coming to present on quarterly basis, you carry along those that have not get unqualified audit, and with their action plans, and then you report how far are you dealing with those issues. So next year we don't want unqualified, we don't want qualified reports with the entities, because you have messed up with the departmental audit. Yes, you have painted with a black brush. So they were we are striving to achieve clean audit. Help us to reach there, all of us, and everybody must work towards there. And transformation is a key issue in the sector, and non-compromise on it. If the law stop us to transform, that is our law, bring it back, and so this section of the law stop us to do the right thing, we'll change it immediately, amend it. That's why we are here as members of parliament. So transformation is a key issue on the sector itself. Our people deserve better from all of us, and thank you very much for attending this meeting. The meeting is adjourned. Thanks.